This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Wednesday, June 8th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last night, Hillary Clinton became the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee. Speaking to supporters in Brooklyn, she talked about the historic importance of this election.
We all believe that America succeeds when more people share in our prosperity, when more people have a voice in our political system, when more people can contribute to their communities. We believe that cooperation is better than conflict, unity is better than division, empowerment is better than resentment, and bridges are better than walls.
Benjamin Wallace Wells joins me to discuss Clinton's and Trump's competing visions of America. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Dorothy.
What did you think of Clinton's speech?
Well, I think this has been a week, if we take a step back, in which Clinton has looked just remarkably effective as a candidate, and Trump has looked flailing and like a bit of a mess. And those are things that we might have expected from the campaigns 12 months ago, but maybe not 12 days ago. The place where the turn began with Clinton was with this really remarkable speech that she gave in San Diego about a week ago, which was ostensibly designed to explain why Trump's foreign policy vision was so flawed. And she did two things in that speech that were really interesting. The first was that she made the case that Trump was too reckless to be president. And that sort of became the headline of the stories after the speech. She talked pretty effectively about the chaos of Trump's ISIS policy. But the second thing that she did, which I think was in a kind of quiet way even more devastating and which built into the speech she gave last night, was that she started to talk about Trump as essentially anti-American. She recalled the times that he had talked about America as a third world country, where he had described our military as a disaster, where he had said that the generals in charge of our policy were not smart compared to he himself, if he could do a better job. She was pretty clearly kind of grabbing the mantle of American exceptionalism. I think that what you saw last night was the ways in which Trump has made that easy for her.
And last night, as in her foreign policy speech, stylistically, it seemed to me she was taking her cues from Reagan, on the one hand, Morning in America, all of that sense of sunny optimism, and from Obama, the red states and blue states, and she kept talking about unity.
But one thing that I think has been really interesting kind of throughout this campaign is to see how much Hillary Clinton has taken from Barack Obama. Her tone during the 2008 campaign was at times quite nasty. It seemed to take her a long time to recognize Obama's essential talent. But in this campaign, there are a number of ways in which she has not only sought to identify herself with him for political advantage, but also seems to have pretty carefully watched what he's done and adopted it. One of the things that kept Obama a liberal was his insistence throughout that America was an exceptional place. You know, in no other country on earth is a story like mine even possible. It's part of how he described himself and introducing himself at the 2004 convention. Hillary Clinton obviously has a long involvement with that kind of theme herself, but it's interesting to see her, in contrast to Sanders, and particularly in contrast to Trump, so directly take up that mantle. If you think about the previous two Republican nominees for president, both John McCain and Mitt Romney were people who you imagined, you know, woke up at 5:45 and spent 15 minutes gazing into the American flag to remember who they were as a person and what the country had meant to them. Donald Trump is not like that. And I think that in this past week, she's found a very effective way of explaining not just how he operates as a figure of offense, but how he operates in direct opposition to sort of American tradition and to the American idea.
She said last night that Trump's slogan, "Let's make America great again," is code for "Let's take America backwards." And I thought that was very clever. She talked about stoking fear, so she didn't need to call him a racist because Republicans are doing that for her right now. But it also was a way for her to project herself forward. There's been so much criticism about her representing the past.
One thing that Hillary Clinton is beginning to excavate from the complexity of the primary campaign is the idea of herself as a historic candidate. Again, here, I think that the contrast with Trump is important for her. It allows her sort of quietly to be seen as something much more modern than what she is running against. And in a way where she seemed in 2008 sort of stodgy and of an older time than Barack Obama, the fact that she stands a good chance of being the first woman president ever has a power against Trump that it might not have otherwise.
She'll also soon be aided in that effort by Obama himself, who it sounds like can hardly wait to get out on the campaign trail. And the idea of the first African-American president campaigning for someone who could be the first female president is a pretty remarkable thing.
And I think it is interesting that he waited till now. I think that part of what is needed for the Democratic Party in general is some kind of reconciliation of the Bernie Sanders energy with the party generally. Having Obama do this now and soon allows him not just to stand for Clinton against Trump, to be a sort of partisan figure, but to make a case that I think maybe along with Elizabeth Warren, he's pretty uniquely qualified to make of why what the Bernie Sanders supporters want is inherent in the Democratic Party and is inherent in Clinton's campaign. Add to that, he's probably as funny in cutting an anti-Trump surrogate as Clinton has. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch him over the next couple of weeks.
I want to play another clip from last night's speech.
We all want an economy with more opportunity and less inequality, where Wall Street can never wreck Main Street again. We all want a government that listens to the people, not the power brokers, which means getting unaccountable money out of politics. And we all want a society that is tolerant, inclusive, and fair.
Ben, this is going to be an ongoing problem for her, isn't it, given her ties to Wall Street and the allegations just about where some of the money to the Clinton Foundation has come from?
It seems like it is just about the whole of Donald Trump's Oppo research operation at this point. You know, he said last night that he'll be giving a speech on probably Monday, he said, in which he goes through and gives his account of the Clintons during the 90s and why that's disqualifying. He said recently in an interview with Michael Wolff that he was reading the Ed Klein takedown of Hillary Clinton. It's not just that she's vulnerable. It's that it seems that Donald Trump, you know, who doesn't really have an opposition research department, is going to be spending much of his anti-Clinton energy on these sort of public scandal things. And so part of that will be the 90s. Part of that will be, you know, money in politics, which is a theme that he has harped on throughout the race. I think it is a continuing vulnerability for her. I suspect if she's elected president, it will not stop being a vulnerability. But in this particular moment, I think that Donald Trump is going to throw just about everything he has at it, both as a way of going after her and also as a way of distracting attention from the horrible racism that he showed in the last week.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
There was another interesting moment last night. Sanders, as we know, talks constantly about America's rigged system. Last night, in Trump's speech from Briarcliff,
he used the same words, yeah.
Exactly. He used it to try to appeal to his supporters, and he said,
to all of those Bernie Sanders voters who have been left out in the cold by a rigged system of superdelegates, we welcome you with open arms. My goal is always, again, to bring people together. But if I'm forced to fight for something I really care about, I will never, ever back down, and our country will never, ever back down.
Ben, what common ground do Trump voters and Sanders voters have?
I think that there is an argument to be made, both if you look at demographics and if you look at some of the things that Sanders voters have said, that there's some small portion of them who might be attracted by Trump's outsiderness and who are specifically angered by the kinds of things that Sanders has talked about through the whole campaign, about the corruption of Washington, about the power of the billionaire class. But at the end of the day, Sanders voters are, for the most part, Democrats. They are generally very liberal. And the collision of those voters with Donald Trump just doesn't seem like a natural match. I do think that there is a danger for Clinton. And you see how absolutely high the number of Americans who see her unfavorably are. She comes out of this primary campaign just not a popular figure at all, even among Democrats. And I think the danger for her is that people simply sit out. And so I think that's part of what Trump is trying to do there, is just sort of to try to make that easier for some voters, to try to say to them, remember that there's enough that I share with Bernie Sanders that it may not be the end of the world if I am elected.
And yet, as you point out, this has been another really bad week for Trump as Republican leaders attack him for his obsession with the ethnic background of Gonzalo Curiel, the judge overseeing a lawsuit targeting Trump University. This, it seems to me, just poses a huge dilemma for those in the party. House Speaker Paul Ryan comes immediately to mind, who have reluctantly endorsed him, but then are attacking him for racism.
Yeah. It's a dilemma that I don't think is going to abate anytime soon, because I doubt that this is the last time that Donald Trump says something crazy. At first, Amy Davidson wrote about this very elegantly, there was a kind of learned helplessness that the Republicans put on, that's Amy's phrase. They were going to denounce Trump and sort of make it clear that they didn't stand with this kind of rhetoric, but at the same time, they were going to say, he's our guy. And I thought it was an interesting moment when Paul Ryan came out and didn't just say, I don't agree with what he said, but said, this is a textbook definition of racism. And then he also went on and said, I'm not pulling away from Trump, but that he was willing to use such pointed language, I think underscores how far apart Trump and many leading Republicans still are. I mean, look, he's going to be heading into a convention in Cleveland where his hope for election lies largely on, by his own sort of argument, by winning the votes of white middle class voters in the Rust Belt. The Republican governors in those states are either skeptical of him and have expressed that skepticism, or they've said actively, we're not going to endorse him. There is a kind of formal willingness to sort of paper over their differences, but it seems pretty obvious that that paper is awfully thin, and the chasm between Trump and those Republicans who he very much needs to campaign for him is still pretty great.
There's also talk again now suddenly about and from the Stop Trump movement. Do you see that as actually developing into something formidable for him?
It may be the case that some white knight appears on a horse and says, I'm here, I'm standing for this, and that there is a groundswell that gets behind him. But the actual efforts to try to generate an opposition candidate at this point have been pretty meager. And it seems to me that with every passing day, just the structural obstacles and the political obstacles to doing so become too great. So I suspect that the Never Trump movement morphs in some ways in the way that Lindsey Graham has morphed, which is just into this kind of like constant pushback from Republicans against Trump. And I suspect that you see that through the campaign.
Doesn't all of this signal an implosion in the Republican Party? I know we've been over this ground before, but it just becomes more and more evident that these problems cannot be reconciled.
It absolutely does. I don't think there's any other way to describe it. If you want to make a case for the Republicans right now, I think there has been something moving about the feelings that get brought up in response to Trump. This sense of commitment to a kind of conservative small town values that you have from the Southern Baptist Convention folks, you know, a sense that what Trump represents is something sort of culturally abhorrent. Paul Ryan's sort of repugnance, which I think is genuinely and deeply felt, at the open racism of Trump. It feels like there is a crucible there of a party that clarifies what it does and doesn't believe in.
But Ryan is trying to have it both ways. How long can he continue to do that? You can't call him a racist on the one hand and then on the other say, but I'm standing by him.
I think that he's very much hoping that he can have it both ways until, you know, November 15th or so.
One final question about Hillary, who is trying to appeal simultaneously to Sanders voters and to Republicans and independents who just can't stomach Trump. How does she do that?
I think she does that by running as simple a campaign as she can. I think that one way in which Sanders made things difficult for her was that he brought up issues that she had to try to get on both sides of. Her own involvement with the economy, her own role in Clintonism during the 90s, are difficult things in the Democratic primary. I think what she wants to do in this next long phase of the campaign is stay as broad and almost as metaphorical as possible. And I think that speech last night gave you a little bit of a sense of what she may be going forward, which is somebody who tries to cast as broad a canvas as possible over the idea of America, to not be wedged into taking one side or another, and just to insist that Donald Trump in so many ways is outside of that, is not part of the tent, is antagonistic to those traditions. I suspect that the Clinton that her advisors want is something very much like the one we've seen the last week, where she is citing the central traditions of the country and when she is not actually talking about policy so much.
Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you.
Benjamin Wallace Wells is a staff writer. His work has been collected in the Best American Political Writing. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary from Ben Wallace Wells and others on NewYorker.com or on The New Yorker app, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. Tell us what you thought of this podcast. Rate and review the Politics and More podcast on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Dubuff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.